University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Adolfo Calero, member of the Board of Directors of the Nicaraguan Resistance, with Nicaragua, an update. Calero was both a professor and businessman before his involvement in the Nicaraguan Resistance. In 1956, he joined the Conservative Party and served as its treasurer for several years. He remained active until 1976, when the Somoza regime became linked to the party. He then founded the Authentic Conservative Party and served as its delegate to the Broad Opposition Front, a coalition of political organizations created to coordinate the civic opposition against Somoza. After the fall of Somoza in 1979, he took the position of political coordinator of the Democratic Conservative Party, but was forced into exile by the Sandinistas in 1982. A year later, Calero became president of the National Directorate of the Nicaraguan Democratic Force. In 1987, he was elected to his current position, representing the conservative political current on the directorate. Calero holds a degree in business administration from the University of Notre Dame and did graduate work at Syracuse University. He received his law degree from the Central American University in Managua.
Controversial issues and bringing controversial speakers to the campus. Today's speaker is in that tradition, and if you saw the demonstrators outside, you can tell. Adolfo Calero has been a prominent businessman in Nicaragua. He is a manager for W.R. Grace & Company. Prior to his departure in Nicaragua, he was the manager of the Coca-Cola bottling plant. In 1982, he left Nicaragua to come to the United States, where he joined the Nicaraguan Democratic Force and became a leader of that organization. Today, he remains an important leader of that organization and has been a center of many of the controversies that have surrounded the Nicaraguan Contras. Controversies including the allegations of drug running of Contra rebels, including the current controversy over the president of Panama, Noriega, the controversy at one time where he provided $90,000 in traveler's checks to Oliver North, as well as allegations of close ties to the United States Central Intelligence Agency. I'd like you to welcome Adolfo Calero to Nebraska Wesleyan University.
I certainly appreciate the opportunity to address, as the professor said, a very controversial issue, which is the situation in Nicaragua, in Central America. Nicaragua and the United States have had a long historic relationship. While this country was fighting the British for its independence, Nicaragua, still Spanish colony, was fighting the British also to keep them off our Atlantic coast. We would not have been successful had it been for the first timid application of the Monroe Doctrine, which was proclaimed by President Monroe in 1823. And in 1850, there was a treaty between England and the United States, the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty, which kept the British off the east coast of Nicaragua. Otherwise, Nicaragua would have had the same situation as Guatemala with a British colony on its territory, such as Belize, which is now an independent country. Relations between our two countries came even closer in 1912, when the first contingent of U.S. Marines was sent to Nicaragua to help suppress a rebellion that was taking place there, to help keep order in the country. And the Marines remained in Nicaragua in small numbers and large numbers, like in 1925, and fought against a Nicaraguan nationalist called Sandino, who was later assassinated by the dictator Somoza, who took power in 1933. And referring to Somoza, President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, used to refer to him as an SOB, but our SOB. And that seemed to be the way that United States foreign policy was conducted, at least with regards to some of our countries. Somoza, the Somoza family, the Somoza dynasty, was definitely backed by this country, both by Republican and Democratic presidents, and it was not until the presidency of Jimmy Carter that there was a determination to end such protection. However, the protection ended in such a way that provided the opportunity for the communists to take over after a revolution that overthrew the last of the Somozas, Anastasio Somoza Jr., who was a graduate of West Point. In 1978, right in the midst of what was already a rebellion against the Somoza dictatorship, there was a mediation effort led by the United States and two diplomatic representatives from Dominican Republic and Guatemala. This effort consisted in having a peaceful transition in Nicaragua to democracy. The Nicaraguan moderate parties backed this peaceful transition, while the Sandinistas continued to arm themselves and to attract young Nicaraguans to fight a war against Somoza. Drift and indecision on the part of the Carter administration and stubbornness on the part of Somoza prevented this peaceful transition from taking place, and Somoza was finally pressed into leaving the country by the armed effort of the Sandinistas and an apolitical decision by the Organization of American States, which called for the replacement of the Somoza government and the establishment of a democracy respectful of freedom, respectful of human rights, and all rights of Nicaraguans. The Sandinistas accepted such a political settlement. They endorsed the OAS resolution and betrayed the OAS and betrayed the Nicaraguan people and faulted on every commitment that they had made to freedom and democracy. Nonetheless, the United States, right after the takeover, had helped the Sandinista government to the tune of $120 million. So there could be no accusation, as it was made in the case of Cuba, that U.S. policy had forced the Sandinistas into the arms of the Soviet Union. The truth is that they had a communist agenda before they got to power. They had their ties with Cuba and the Soviet Union, and no matter how much aid they would have gotten, they would have still tried to install in Nicaragua and consolidate in Nicaragua a communist regime. Bayardo Arce, one of the nine commanders, once ironically commented that theirs was to be the first communist revolution that was to be financed with capitalist dollars. And that was the case for a while until there was a cutoff of U.S. funds to the Sandinista government, a cutoff that took place during the Carter administration and not during the Reagan administration, as many people have thought. In Nicaragua, the effort to get rid of Somoza received the cooperation and contribution of private enterprise. Private enterprise in Nicaragua was very progressive. In Nicaragua, there were good laws. There were many good things before. However, all of these good things were abused by the dictator. And rather than serving the people, they would serve themselves. That is, the dictator plus the small clique that surrounded him. The Sandinistas at first were thought to be democratic reformers. But soon, and I mean weeks after coming into power, they began to suppress freedom, to suppress freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. They began to establish black committees in all neighborhoods throughout the country, committees which would be run by sympathizers of the government and who had very many para-governmental duties to perform. Food rationing was established in Nicaragua not long after the Sandinistas took over, and ration cards, for instance, were in the hands of these black committees who would spy and who would control the population. Trade unions were repressed, and the Sandinistas established their own trade unions. Strikes were outlawed, and a collusion between party, state, and army was established, such as exists in the Soviet Union. Persecution began with the Miskito Indians in the East Coast, and it extended then to other peoples in Nicaragua. There was also persecution of churches. The Jewish community was expelled from the country, and many churches were also thrown out. Jehovah's Witnesses and a few others that I do not remember. The Catholic hierarchy was also persecuted by the Sandinistas, and church and state relations became very, very tense. But that is not the extent of the problem that the Sandinista type, a communist type government, provoked in our country. The economy has become is in shambles now, and this is due to the incapacity of the Sandinistas to run the country, on account of the fact that they have established or have tried to establish a system which is diametrically opposed to the national values of the Nicaraguan people. And the national values of the Nicaraguan people in this order are religion, freedom, religion, family, freedom, and private enterprise. All of those four national values are antithetical to what communism stands for. The communists are atheists. The communists do not permit, suppress freedom, do not permit freedom. The communists try to break up the family, and the communists also believe in state ownership and not in private ownership. And to try to establish a government, a communist-type government, in a country that upheld such national values, which are very similar to yours, of course, ran into difficulties. The suppression of political expression also led to the take-up of arms by people who had fought alongside the Sandinistas against the Somoza dictatorship. And the first to rise up in arms back in 1980 was a commander, the number two Sandinista commander in northern Nicaragua, known as Pedro Joaquín González. He and a group of 60 men were the ones who started the armed struggle against the Sandinistas when they thought that other possibilities to fight them in a civic, political way were not possible. Alongside these men, also former members of the National Guard started to fight the Sandinistas. And that gave room to a Sandinista accusation that members of the old regime were the ones leading and trying to fight a war to regain the lost privileges that they had. And another accusation that has been made is that the Nicaraguan resistance was the creation and was made by the Reagan administration, which is also another false accusation, because people will not put their lives on the line just because someone tells them to do so, and not because they have a real reason to fight. And these Nicaraguans had a real reason to fight, and they began fighting in 1980. To give you an idea, which I have called an economic autopsy of the communist revolution, the situation in Nicaragua, in numbers, in a few indicators, is this. Back in 1977, the per capita income per year was around $900. Today, it's down to about $80. Private consumption has decreased by over 50%. A secretary's monthly salary used to be about $250. Today, it amounts to about $10. A junior executive, a college graduate, would start off in about $1,000. Today, he's earning $30 a month. Exports used to be close to $800 million, and today they are about $200 million. Just one of the exports, beef. We used to export 62 million pounds of beef, principally to the United States, Puerto Rico, and today they are exporting 6 million pounds. And the exchange rate has gone from $1, from 7 Cordoba, which is our monetary unit, to $1 in April of 1979, to 50,000 Cordobas to $1. I was just showing, a little while ago, I was showing the newspapermen a Nicaraguan 50 Cordoba bill, which was re-stamped and is now worth 50,000 Cordobas. This 50 Cordoba bill was worth $7 back in 1979 before the Sandinistas got to power, and today it is worth less than $1. I mean, that simply indicates the type of economic situation that has evolved in the country. The foreign debt, which is another indicator, was $1.6 million after a long dictatorship of the Somoza family, and it is today over $10 billion. So it's more, it's gone up more than five times. Soviet aid, on the other hand, is about, since the revolution, for both military and economic, is $3.5 billion. That does not include aids from other Soviet bloc countries or from Mexico that gave, because Sandinistas never paid for it, gave the Sandinistas $500 million worth of oil. The Nicaraguan people, as I said before, started this revolt, this armed revolt against the Sandinista government on their own. However, they needed outside support in order to continue the struggle against an enemy that counted on a massive Soviet support. And that is why, back in 1981, I was still living in Nicaragua, some sort of relationship began with the leaders of the resistance then and the United States government. And we first received $14 million in 1 year. Then that went up to 24 in 1983, $24 million. In 1984, this U.S. support was cut off, and it was not until 1985 that $27 million in humanitarian aid was given to the resistance. In 1986, finally, the U.S. Congress appropriated $100 million for both military and humanitarian aid. And this aid began to arrive in December of 1986. And beginning in December, January of 1987, the resistance, with adequate support, began having success after success fighting the Sandinistas. In the military field, battles were increased to about 300 combats per month. Destruction of Soviet Mi-24 helicopters grounded the use of these helicopters, which were armored and which had, back in 1985, changed the course of the war in favor of the Sandinistas. And these military successes brought about also political considerations on the part of the Sandinistas. The Contadora process, which started back in January of 1983 and was headed by Mexico, Colombia, Panama, and Venezuela, had not been successful at all in bringing about a settlement in the situation in Nicaragua, in Salvador, where there was a similar situation. The only thing there was that in Salvador there was a democratically elected government and a communist guerrilla, while in Nicaragua we had a communist government and a democratic guerrilla. In 1987, President Arias conceived what has been called the Arias Plan, which the Sandinistas at first refused to even consider because they had announced that there would be no change in the internal political structure of the country, that there would be no meddling by the other Central American countries in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, and the Sandinista government was not ready and would not accept any interference by the other countries. But on account of the political pressure put on by the Nicaraguan resistance, on account of the military pressure, on account of the political pressure put on by what is left of the internal opposition in Nicaragua, on the political and diplomatic pressure put on by the Central American presidents, the Sandinistas attended the meeting in Guatemala in August of 1987, and on the 7th of August, they signed what has been known as the Arias Plan, or the Guatemala, or the Esquipulas peace plan. In this plan, or through this plan, the Sandinistas committed themselves to democratization, to lifting of the state of emergency, which had been established back in 1982 and did not allow any individual freedom in the country, and to an amnesty which would free about 10,000 political prisoners that to this day are in Nicaraguan jails. They also committed themselves to do everything possible to achieve a ceasefire. And that was the part of the agreement, even though we did not sign, that had to do with us, because we were the counterpart to the military struggle. The Sandinistas were given, and the other countries also, were given 5 months to fulfill these commitments. The Sandinistas gave token concessions, made cosmetic changes, permitted the reopening of La Prensa, an independent newspaper, which had been closed down back in 1986, permitted the reopening of a Catholic radio station without its newscast, and gave took some other measures which would lead others, and especially foreigners, to believe that there was a real democratic opening in Nicaragua. But none of the real hardcore commitments were fulfilled by the Sandinistas. And on January 16th, they again were called to sign a joint declaration with the rest of the Central American presidents, committing themselves to the immediate fulfillment of what they had signed in Guatemala, to the immediate and unconditional fulfillment. Immediately after signing it, they started conditioning the amnesty. Immediately after signing it, they started conditioning the ceasefire. However, with continued pressure and more military successes that we had recently had in December, the Sandinistas finally came around to accepting a direct face-to-face negotiation for a ceasefire with the Nicaraguan resistance. And the first round of such a negotiation took place in San Jose, Costa Rica, in the month of January. A second round will take place in Guatemala on the 18th of this month of February, and hopefully it will be possible to bring these people around to fulfill or to comply with the democratization of Nicaragua, which would give Nicaraguans the freedoms that are enjoyed by other Central Americans, and that they will also fulfill their commitment to an amnesty which would free some 10 to 12,000 political prisoners. And then, as the Esquipulas document calls for, we would be ready to simultaneously establish a ceasefire which would create the adequate climate to permit further and broader negotiations for the real implementation of democracy in Nicaragua. Of course, that, what I have just described, would be the ideal situation, would be the number one choice. But the fact of the matter is that since 1979, the Sandinista government has not fulfilled a single commitment, that since 1979, no promise ever made by the Sandinista government has been kept, and that they are committed Marxist, Leninist, bent on the consolidation of a communist regime in Nicaragua. We have not seen in the world a Marxist, Leninist regime taking but one step backward to take two and three forward as soon as it can. However, we of the Nicaraguan resistance, of the Nicaraguan democratic resistance, are ready and have been ready to negotiate such a situation. It might be wishful thinking, but it could become a reality if good intentions are put in place. This brings the point of the congressional vote that took place recently in the House of Representatives. Undoubtedly, that this best scenario that I just described, this almost wishful thinking that I have just stated, was used by many congressmen to determine their vote. Let's give peace a chance was the expression used by many of them. Let's vote against further aid to the Nicaraguan resistance to give peace a chance. Others argued that it was precisely the aid to the Nicaraguan resistance that had brought about the possibility of peace in Nicaragua, because it was not until the resistance became an effective force with U.S. support that the Sandinistas started to mend their ways and started to change and started to open, at least to dialogue and to negotiations with the rest of the Central American countries. The negative vote in the House was a great disappointment to us, and it is quite a blow to us. It certainly places the resistance in a more precarious situation than we have been before. But more than that, it really damages the image and prestige of the United States worldwide. The United States have, throughout the years, abandoned many of its allies. They have not been consistent allies. In Mexico, which is a country that has had many differences with the United States, neighbors to the south, there is a saying that goes, the United States are weak enemies and dangerous friends. I have never taken it by the letter or by the word, but certainly this cutoff, this negative vote, has made me think about it. It will not contribute to the peace effort. It will weaken one of the parts in the negotiation, our part, and it is not consistent with the policy that brought about the changes in attitude of the Sandinista government. However, this vote was not necessarily a vote on this controversial issue. It was not necessarily a vote on the Nicaraguan resistance, on aid to the Nicaraguan resistance or not. More than that, it was a vote which is the result of a tremendous polarization that has been taking place in this country, and which is separating this country into two camps. And when it comes to foreign policy, I don't think it is in the benefit of this country that there should be such polarization over issues of foreign affairs. A bipartisan policy should be found, a bipartisan policy should be adopted to deal with matters of foreign affairs, and domestic differences, party lines, should be set aside in order to look after the best interest of this country. And certainly, it's not that Nicaragua or that the communist government in Nicaragua would declare war against the United States, but that a communist government in Nicaragua, an ally of the Soviet Union, would lend its territory and would lend itself to all sorts of actions against the neighboring countries and against the United States. One must remember that Central America is but 2 hours away by plane from Miami, from New Orleans, and that Central America is within walking distance of the United States, that 400,000 Nicaraguans have already left the country, that there are upwards of 500,000 Salvadorians already in the United States, most of them illegal. And a situation in Central America where a communist government would be consolidated in Nicaragua would certainly mean a lot more exiles, a lot more refugees, and it would certainly mean that the airport that has been built recently in Nicaragua and that can accommodate the biggest Soviet airplanes, bear bombers and rest, would be put to use, that the west coast of the United States, which is now not available for surveillance to the Soviet spy planes, as is the east coast of the United States flying out of Cuba, would be open to this surveillance on the part of the Soviets going out of Nicaragua, that a port in the Pacific coast is being outfitted to serve Soviet ships in the Pacific, and that this would give the Soviets the only other Pacific port besides Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam and their own port of Vladivostok, that Nicaragua could serve the Soviets as a firm or permanent ships where planes land, a permanent a ship where planes can land. Aircraft carrier, yes, that's it. A permanent aircraft carrier, and that Nicaragua could infiltrate agents to this country, and Central America could infiltrate agents to this country through an open border with Mexico. It has been done, but not for purpose of spying or subversion or anything like that, but for purpose of people coming to live in this country. And there are thousands that cross that border every day. Some of them are caught, some are turned back, and some of them come into the country. But one thing that should be kept in mind is the opinion of the other Central Americans, of the other countries in Central America, public opinion in Central America with regards to the Sandinistas, because those are the ones that better understand the situation. Those are the ones that are better acquainted with the situation. There was a Gallup international poll taken in Central America with regards to the Sandinistas a few months ago. And to the question, who do you think, I mean, what do the Sandinistas represent in Nicaragua? The majority or the minority? And in Costa Rica, 79% answered minority. In Honduras, 75%. Salvador, 64%. In Guatemala, 64%. Neighboring countries of Nicaragua are Honduras to the north, Costa Rica to the south. To the question, which side of the conflict do you think the majority of the Nicaraguan people support? Siding with the resistance, or saying that the resistance represented the majority, were 72% in Costa Rica, 75% in Honduras, 46% in Salvador, and 60% in Guatemala. To the question of who treats civilians better, the Sandinistas or the resistance, Costa Rica, 72% the resistance, 6% the Sandinistas. In Honduras, 74% the resistance, 6% the Sandinistas. In El Salvador, 45% and 10%. In Guatemala, 60% and 18%. And to the question, do you approve or disapprove of American military aid to the resistance? Approve, 70% in Costa Rica, 81% in Honduras, 69% in El Salvador, and 68% in Guatemala. Those people in those countries closer to Nicaragua, and you saw how Costa Rica and Honduras that were closer, the percentages that favored the resistance were greater than Guatemala and Salvador that are farther away. The fact of the matter is that We, Nicaraguan Democrats, are fighting for freedom, that there can be freedom, there can be peace in Nicaragua if there is freedom, if there is democracy, that the Nicaraguan people in recent years have had the experience of living under a rightist dictatorship and under a leftist dictatorship, and that it is time for us to live under a democratic form of government, that only under a democratic form of government will there be peace in Nicaragua, that the Nicaraguan resistance is ready to make that peace, but we do not want a peace in the Polish style or the Cuban style or the East German or Hungarian style. We want a peace in the style that you people are used to here in this country, or that other Central American countries like Costa Rica and Honduras enjoy, and other Latin American countries also have such type of peace, that we are not after a utopic form of government, that we are not insistent that we must have a perfect democracy or that we will continue the war, that we are ready to settle for democratic improvement, that we are ready to settle for a democratization process which cannot be reversed overnight or cannot be just discontinued through a legislative process, and having President Ortega sign again a state of emergency as he signed back in 1982, that we Nicaraguans have a right to live in freedom and peace, and that we also have a right to reject formulas, accommodations that other people recommend that we adopt. And these people that recommend that we adopt and that we accept or accommodate with a communist government are not ready to accept it for themselves or for their countries. And we have had a lot of that. In Central America, there are politicians there that are ready to accept for us what they wouldn't accept for themselves. And there are people in this country, and that opinion was voiced in the congressional debate over aid to the resistance, that are ready to accept for us what they would never have for themselves. I believe that time is over. We will have a question and answer period beginning at 11, in which we can go deeper into these questions. And I will invite you to make hard questions, to really go deep into the problem, because the harder the question, the better that I can explain to you what the real situation in Nicaragua is. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented Adolfo Calero, member of the Board of Directors of the Nicaraguan Resistance. He spoke on Nicaragua, an update. The question and answer period will not be broadcast due to time considerations. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.